1, 2, 3, 4.
Thanks for listening to this podcast produced by Diddy TV. Visit DiddyTV.com for more exclusive on-demand content or download the official Diddy TV app from your app store today. From Diddy TV, this is Insights, a conversation-driven show where today, Amy Wright sits down with acclaimed singer-songwriter, much-admired activist, and champion of civil rights and progressive thought, Mary Gaucher. Mary made a breathtaking collection of songs that she recently released as a studio album titled Dark Enough to See the Stars, and you'll get to hear all about the inspiration behind and making of the record today. It's her 11th album, the follow-up to the profound Rifles and Rosary Beads, her 2018 collaborative work with Wounded Iraq War Veterans. That record garnered a Grammy nomination for Best Folk Album, as well as a nomination for Album of the Year by the Americana Music Association. So that should give you an idea of the caliber of artist Mary truly is. We're so honored to host her on the show today and excited to hear what she has to say. So without further ado, here's Amy Wright with Mary Gaucher on Insights.
Thanks for coming and talking to us about Dark Enough to See the Stars. That's the latest album, but we kind of wanted to go back a little ways and talk about your life and then get to the new album, because that's very exciting. And I have to say that you're a very inspiring person.
Thank you. I mean, I'm a late bloomer.
Well, you're not only a late bloomer, but you had to overcome a lot to get to where you are. And, you know, that's an inspiring story in and of itself, but you took it to a new level. So you went way past what most people would have accomplished, you know, having to overcome as much as you did. But I thought we would go back and talk a little bit about growing up in New Orleans, and where it was right outside New Orleans, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Baton Rouge, New Orleans, Thibodaux. South Louisiana.
So do you consider yourself kind of a New Orleans person? I mean, what was it like growing up there?
Well, you know, I think of myself as from Louisiana.
Yeah.
But I, citizen of the world. Yeah. You know, I'm Southern because of being born in New Orleans, raised in Baton Rouge, and then I went around a bit and then back to Baton Rouge for 5 years of college, and then I left for good. But I definitely have Southern heritage, and I also feel the, you know, the Cajun thing. My last name's Gaucher, and you know, ancestors that come from Eastern Canada, but I was adopted, and so I'm kind of one removed from everything. Being adopted is weird, and so there's a sort of a pause in it, you know. It's like, I think I'm from there. I mean, I don't know. I don't have the story, you know, of what happened that brought me to Earth. I just kind of woke up here. I don't have a birth story. I spent the first year of my life in a place called St. Vincent de Paul's, and it was where unmarried women and girls went when they got pregnant. In those days, the babies were put up for adoption through the Catholic Church, if they were Catholic girls. And I spent my first year there and was adopted by an Italian Catholic family in South Louisiana, as was my adoptive brother and other members of my extended family. So, I mean, it's a tricky old story that lends itself to songwriting, that's for sure.
I was going to say, there's a lot of stories there. How did you sort of deal with all those issues? I mean, that's a lot to deal with as a kid.
Well, I became a raging drug addict and a horrible alcoholic was my first coping mechanism. I quit school, ran away from home, was deeply troubled, didn't know why, and I struggled. And all of those strategies failed, and I ended up getting sober in 1990. And after I got sober, I started writing songs, and songs led me to start to make sense of what had happened when I was a little person. And I think music and song have been my salvation, to be honest, and my sobriety. I'm 32 years sober now. And
congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, so I wrote a book about it. I've written songs about it, and I'm just able to create from some of that confusion, and it brings me peace. And I mean, I called the book Saved by a Song for a reason. I think it's been my salvation to be an artist.
I know the book came out last year, and I love the title, Saved by a Song. What was that salvation for you? What was that turning point in your life? And was it music for you, or was it something else, and then music kind of came from that?
Yeah, you know, I was in the restaurant business in Boston. I had three different restaurants going. I had investors who put the money down, and I came up with the ideas. And opening night of my second restaurant, I got arrested for drunk driving. And that was my come to Jesus moment. And I was able to get sober, July 1990. And I've been sober ever since. So I was in the kitchens for 10 years, cooking and running the restaurant sober. And started writing songs after I got brought to an open mic by one of my waitresses. And I just saw her up on stage singing an original song, and I thought, God, I want to do that. And I started writing songs and going to open mics and playing them. So it was a process of becoming a songwriter. And then the music and songs started to be, because I stayed sober, a way of metabolizing my story in a new way. And it slowly over time became deeply attached to my purpose. And I think that's been the long answer to a question that you just asked, which is, how did it become a salvation? Yeah. I think it attached to purpose, mm-hmm. and it gave me a reason to get up in the morning, and it still does.
So when did you start playing guitar? Was that when you were younger, or was that as an adult?
I had a guitar when I was a kid. I thrashed at it a little bit. I didn't get good at it. I'm still not that good at it. I got my little thing that I do. But I really went to the open mics with a sort of a songwriter mentality. Like, I'm too old. I started at 40, you know. I'm too old to become a great musician, but I'm not too old to become a great songwriter. And so in my estimation, I think of a musician as someone who studies the instrument. And I never did. I studied the art form of songwriting and used the instrument to expedite that. But I don't have a deep knowledge of music theory or really how to professionalize my playing. But my heroes didn't either. You know, nobody would say, John Prine, what a guitar player. You know, or Hank Williams, boy, could he play guitar, or Johnny Cash. We know enough to write songs, and simple songs. But the beauty of a simple song is that it's only simple on the surface. The emotional depths of a simple song are actually quite complex.
No, it's true. When you hear a simple song and the lyrics are so carefully chosen that even in 3 minutes, it can send you to tears. It's amazing, the power of words.
Yeah, combined with music, mm-hmm. combine lyric, music, and truth, yeah. Emotional truth, and you end up with a pretty transformative art form that I think can alchemize trauma in some ways. I've certainly used that to alchemize some of my trauma, and in the work I've done with veterans over the last 10 years, co-writing with wounded veterans, using music and song to articulate the ineffable, really. You can't get to it with just words, but melody can get in there and point to that truth that's inside this person or inside me, and then bring it out. And, you know, I always say that songs are, when they're working, they show your insides on the outside. And this allows you to be seen and known, and that is how we connect.
So when did you actually begin songwriting or music as a career? When did you make that break from your restaurants, and then you transitioned to just being a musician? And was that hard? Was it hard to give up kind of a steady gig that you obviously were good at. You had three restaurants that you were managing, and you know, music is an unknown at that point. What was that leap?
Yeah, it was terrifying. It was horrifying, terrifying, and I tried to make myself not do it. It was so scary because, like you said, I had a steady gig and I was the boss and it was working.
Yeah.
But I wasn't happy. Mm-hmm. And I didn't love it the way that I did in the beginning. And it became a bit of an albatross. I didn't want to be responsible for all those people and their families. And I didn't... I didn't enjoy the success the way that one would if it was your purpose. Uh-huh. And so because I was so sober, and because in recovery they talk about becoming more real, I had to be honest that what I really, really loved was music and song. I had fallen out of love with the kitchen and fallen in love with being a songwriter. And so it wasn't an event that I just quit. It was a process. You know, it was a whisper that became a conversation, that became me going to open mics regularly, that became me making a record and then making another record. And then I got invited to play, of all things, the Newport Folk Festival.
Wow.
And to me, that was the universe going, you wouldn't be on that stage if you suck. It doesn't happen. So maybe, just maybe, you should take this seriously and go to Nashville and dedicate yourself to it. And if it doesn't work, you could always go open another restaurant, find investors and come up with another restaurant. So that was my process, you know. I got in this sort of process after I got sober. And then the universe started saying, you can do this, because of clues that were being dropped. I won this, I didn't win. I was nominated for a Boston Music Award for Best New Artist. And I didn't win, but the nomination was astonishing. Like, Best New Artist? I mean, in Boston there's 5 million people playing music, and I'm one who's nominated in this category of four people. That's a validation that I had to take seriously. And so I moved to Nashville in 2001, and I've been here ever since.
So you pack your bags, you moved to Nashville. Do you remember arriving, and did you know people? I mean, mm-hmm. what was that like? Or you're arriving cold.
Arriving cold. yeah, and a relationship had ended, so she went her way. I went to Nashville. And I came here, you know, just hoping that I could figure out a few. I mean, looking back on it now, the audacity of it all is kind of amazing to me. but I started knocking on doors, and some people answered, and I ended up with... one thing that helped me is my booking agent was here in Nashville. At the time, I was being booked by Keith Case, and he also booked Guy Clark. And he had put me on the road with Guy. And so I was opening for Guy for quite a while there. And I started banging on the door of Albanetta, who managed John Prine, begging Al to let me open for John. And so I got that gig. I was able to open for John. And then I knocked on the door of Harlan Howard Songs. Harlan had just recently passed away, but his widow started working with me. And she got me a record deal on Universal Lost Highway. And then I started being connected, and Nashville has been really good to me, and continues to be a place where I feel very comfortable. I like being here. I like that I came here. I think it was the right place.
What was it like sharing the stage with John Prine? It was obviously one of your songwriting heroes. When you first met him, what was that like?
I'm scared to death.
I would be.
It was nerve-wracking, to be honest, because I don't think of myself as a singer. I don't think of myself as a musician. I'm a songwriter. I'm up there croaking my way through it. But, see, John feels the same way, or felt the same way. He would make stage jokes about his, you know, his his scars from his cancer surgery. He's, you know, he said, it screwed up my voice, but nobody will notice because it was already screwed up. And so he was really kind to me, and he brought me up to sing Paradise at the end of every show. Got a verse, got to sing with him. I don't know how to sing harmony, so I just sang in tandem with him. It gave me confidence. You know, I was nervous, though. It was like, it just felt surreal. And, you know, and I got to be on stage with Willie Nelson, and his manager managed me for a year. Mark Rothbaum put me on the road with Willie onto the bus with that crew in the United Kingdom. And I'm like, I feel like Forrest Gump. Like, how is this happening to me? I got to sing the gospel finale with Willie, and Will the Circle Be Unbroken? And it's a medley, and it goes on, and he stands on stage, and the band plays, and he signs, you know, records and hats and shirts and neckerchiefs, and he, you know, the band will play the finale thing, and it was, and is still kind of amazing to me. It feels like a movie, like I'm in a movie.
I know Willie Nelson's like a musical shaman, you know, he's just sort of one of those people everyone's drawn to. But, you know, here's the thing, like you said, the signs were in the universe that this is what you needed to do with your life, and you're doing it, and you've been incredible at it. So it was obviously your calling. And what was the first album you put out under the label, and what did that sort of, how did your life change after that first album?
Yeah, the first album that came out on the major label, Universal Lost Highway, is called Mercy Now. And that was the big springboard because of the marketing budget. You know, the major label put $500,000 into branding my name. Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. To this day, thank you. They got me introduced to Mark Rothbaum, who's Willie's manager. Willie was on the label as well. And that got me into a different tier of opportunities. And then we got me on CBS Sunday Morning and big, big things that brought me into the public eye and ears that to this day I still ride the momentum of that. And I still work with the publicist that was at that label. That label folded. Everybody that worked there scattered and went into other jobs. But the publicist that was on Lost Highway is still my publicist, Jim Flamia. We've been together for 20 years.
We love Jim. He's great.
I can't imagine working with anybody else. He's my guy. And so I got to keep him, thankful. The experience was great, because even though it was a major label, it was an imprint off of a major label, and we didn't have the same rules. There weren't mandates to have hits and be on the radio and be commercial. It wasn't that way. It was, you know, Lucinda, Ryan Adams, myself. For a while, it was Hayes Carl and Tiff Merritt. And they put out the Cash records on American Recordings that ran through Lost Highway. And so there were, you know, outsiders, outlaws, and people who just didn't play by the rules, and that was fun.
So do you like performing as well?
Mm, I love being on stage, yeah. Yeah, I love being, I'm a troubadour at heart. When I left the restaurant business, it was my deepest wish to not have to run a large number of people employed by me ever again. I don't have the disposition for it. And I didn't want to do it. I didn't want to be responsible for me. And that's kind of what I've done. I'm a troubadour. Spotlight, bottle of water, bar stool, stories and songs. And you know, I'll hire a band for some festivals, and I'll hire a band probably for the Franklin Theater CD release show, but that's a one of or a couple of shows. I don't have a touring band or a bus or all those things that I didn't want. You know, I kind of like the freedom of it being a troubadour career, and I travel light, and I love the freedom of it.
You know, you mentioned your work with veterans and co-writing songs with veterans, and you put out in 2018. You released Rifles and Rosemary Beads. and you co-wrote the songs with veterans. How did this project come about?
Yeah, I've been a part of a nonprofit that paired songwriters with wounded veterans. And I started writing songs with the wounded veterans. They're not songwriters, but they have story, and we just bear witness and help tell their story. And so these songs started piling up, and at a certain point, I asked for permission to make a record of 10 of them. And it went on to be called Rifles and Rosary Beads, and the experience of putting that out into the world was incredible, being able to tell the veterans' stories and sort of help build a bridge across the civilian-military divide, because we have that in this country. There's a real separation between those who've served and their families and those who are civilians. And it helping to explain some of what our veterans go through and are going through has been a real privilege. And I still, to this day, play those songs, and I have an affinity for it. It's a privilege.
Was it cathartic for the veterans as well to kind of get their story out there? Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I imagine it would be.
Oh, yeah, because it helps people to understand something that they can't explain. You can't, when you have deep trauma, there's no words. It's ineffable. But music has the ability to go where words cannot reach. Even poetry, even metaphor. Music can creep in and explain.
How did you draw the story out of them?
Well, bearing witness in non-judgment, creating safety, really listening, not inserting myself, and not asking them to recount their most traumatic moments, but just listening and figuring what it is that they wanted to say and are comfortable saying, and using that as the springboard. And the songs almost write themselves when you have someone with you who has such story inside them.
So let's talk about the new album, Dark Enough to See the Stars. It's being released on 30 Tigers. And I had the privilege of listening to the whole album, and I love every song. It's just beautifully written. The melodies are gorgeous. You must be really proud of this album.
Thank you. I am. It is a labor of love. This record is complicated in that it's the story of mature adult love. I'm in a wonderful relationship with a beautiful person, and I'm happy. And that has not been my story for most of my life. So it's like, yay, before I die, I get to have this. And so it's just joyful. And then there's also the complexity of what's playing on in the background is the pandemic and grief and loss and people that are close to me passing away. And so there's this complex, tangled, tricky emotional story of romantic love and grief happening simultaneously in my life, and a sense of wonder at all of it. It's been a surreal couple of years. It really has, for all of us.
It has been a surreal couple of years, and I think there's some positives and negatives that were going on. I mean, I think a lot of us that had to slow down, and that wasn't the worst thing, but it took us out of our routines and just put us in a whole new world we didn't really comprehend that well. What were you doing during the pandemic? Were you writing these songs, but were you doing other things as well?
Well, I finished the book during the pandemic in the early stages, and then it came out in 2021, so that gave me, you know, I'm off the road completely, so I just was able to sit and focus and finish the manuscript and get that to the finish line was a big deal. And then I definitely upped my game with co-writing. And also every Sunday we did a live stream from here in the office and reached out to the listeners around the world. And I'm still doing that on Sunday afternoons when I'm not on the road. And people love the intimacy of it. It's not a polished professional television show. It's a live stream from my office. I call it Sunday with Mary. And I'm having friends come over now. Yesterday, Allison Mora dropped in, and we just swapped songs. And I'll bring musical friends in, And sometimes I'll just do it solo. Sometimes I'll read from the book. I'll take questions. So we pivoted pretty quickly to the live stream format. And I used the time to complete this song cycle and get this record to the finish line as well, and the book.
So when you wrote Saved by a Song, was that like a pivotal moment in your life, just like, I can talk about all this and put it behind me? Or did you have to reach a certain place in your life that you could even do that?
Well, you know, the honest reason why I wrote the book is because I got a book deal, you know? Mm-hmm. They paid me to write the book, and that became my job. I'm going to write the book. Now, I always wanted to write a book, but the level of difficulty in writing a book is so high that I probably would have never done it unless I was given this opportunity to do it for a publisher. And so I'm grateful for St. Martin's Press for bringing me on board and giving me a deadline and making it my job. You write the book because your job is to write this book. But the beauty of the book is that it gave me a deeper understanding of, I don't know, the events of my life and the way that one thing led to another, and how music and song has been such an important part of my recovery, and how I was able to take what I learned and use it to help other people dealing with trauma, and how they were able to then help other people, and the chain of service that radiates outward when one person gets sober is pretty incredible.
Well, you know, Dark Enough to See the Stars is sort of, when I just read the title, it made me think of clarity. And I wasn't sure what your intention was, and I hadn't listened to all the music at that point, but that's the first thing that came to mind was, I've achieved clarity in some way. What did the title mean to you?
I think that's a wonderful insight. My sense is that growth comes through pain. Growth doesn't come through a desire to grow. Growth comes through pain. I'm talking about emotional, spiritual growth, because we gets our attention. And once it has our attention, we're given opportunities to internalize some lessons. And so clarity is a great way of looking at that. That sense of what matters. The focusing of the lens, of the camera. It happens when we're grieving and when we're in pain. And pain can be purposeful if we get the lesson, or if I get the lesson. Honestly, I think the metaphor came from a Dr. King speech, and what he was talking about was the lash of racism and oppression in America, and offering this metaphor as a ray of hope to the people he was talking to. And that's, I bring it as a ray of hope as well, that we've been in quite a dark time. But we've had this opportunity to focus on what is important and what does matter. And do I want to live the rest of my life in a relationship with what matters? And now that I've been given some idea of what matters, I've been slowed to a halt, you know, what do I do with that? And for me, the real answer is I want to love people better. And be more present.
So where did you record the album?
In Nashville. I recorded it in East Nashville with Dylan Aldridge and at the Dials and Nielsen Hubbard as a producer. And the band is all Nashville people. And we had a really good time doing it. Everybody was vaccinated, and we didn't have to wear masks, and we went into the studio and did it in 5 days.
Was it fun to be back with people? It sounds like it was during that time when we were all kind of in our corners and not being able to see anybody. I remember feeling very isolated. And when we finally started to be able to be in person again, I'll never take it for granted. Let me just say that.
It was right after right after the vaccines came out and people started to get that sense of thank you, you know, and also I think a lot of us had been on the road and had gotten off the road, and then once we got vaccinated, we felt we could go back on the road, and then Omicron came, and we realized, oh, shoot, everybody's getting COVID even though they're vaccinated, and then started to realize, well, if you're vaccinated and you get Omicron, you're not going to have as serious an illness as if you weren't vaccinated, and that was the time we got the second shot, I think, if I remember right, and then we went in the studio. But it's blurry, isn't it? Like, I think I've had three shots at this point.
Yeah, no, I had three shots and then I got COVID, just like you're describing. And then I said, okay, I got that monkey off my back now. I can just not worry about this anymore. The vaccine worked. You know, I just have to keep going back in for whatever booster they offer.
That's how I feel about it. I was vaccinated, triple vaxxed, and I got it.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it was double vaxxed, and I got it, and I realized, wow, the vaccine's working. This is pretty miserable, but I'm not in the hospital. I don't want to get it again, but there's also a relief in that I didn't end up being one of the ones that would be end up hospitalized in spite of being vaccinated. There's some relief in that. And
absolutely.
Natural immunity.
I know, I felt pretty emboldened after I had it. I said, hey, you know, I can go anywhere now.
Right? For a little while, anyway.
For a little while. I got a short period of time to run out and see some shows and big stadiums and whatever else. Let's talk about some of the songs on the album. It starts with The Meadow, which I thought was, you know, kind of a beautiful metaphor. Tell me about that song.
Yeah, I wrote that song with one of my favorite co-writers, Ben Glover, a songwriter who's from Belfast. He lives in Nashville now, but when I met him and started writing with him, he lived in Belfast, Northern Ireland. And it's from an inspiration that we got from a book written by Odie Lindsay, who is a Vanderbilt professor and also a veteran. The book takes place in Mississippi, lower southern Mississippi, and it's written from the perspective of a female veteran who comes home and is trying to rebuild her life. And so in my mind, that's who the narrator is in that song. And driving, you know, Highway 90, that famous highway down the Gulf Coast, and trying to make sense of her marriage and how to stay, trying to figure out how to stay. It's hard to stay when you're highly traumatized.
It is hard to stay when you're highly traumatized. And I remember you mentioned Pascagoula, Mississippi, in the song, and I've been there many times, so.
Yeah, me too.
There's nothing like kind of being along the coast that Gulf Coast area through Mississippi, Alabama, Florida.
It's a beautiful part of the world, and it's a vulnerable part of the world. You know, hurricanes hit hard down there, and the barrier islands don't protect it, and it's, you know, those towns are dangling, you know, and the coasts are eroding, and it's haunted and gorgeous and southern, and it's got all of that weight. It's an incredible part of our country.
Yeah, well, you know, we are, speaking of that, we are on the Gulf today.
I feel it.
Yeah, our studio's in Memphis. That's where the network is, and that's where we normally are, but we are filming down here. And we happen to be doing this, your interview, from the Gulf Coast. And we had a big storm earlier, and it's just beautiful. There's nothing like it, standing out on the balcony and, you know, just the power of the water and the waves and everything else.
The mighty, mighty Gulf. Yes, indeed.
Yeah, it's just beautiful. So let's talk about Amsterdam. Amsterdam is a single that you released. I happen to love Amsterdam. I went to Amsterdam to see the Starry Night Van Gogh painting, and it was on loan to some museum in the U.S.
In New York City.
Right. It was in New York City at the time. But I still had a blast in Amsterdam, and there's so much going on there. But what does Amsterdam mean to you?
Well, I'm very familiar with Holland. My first record deal was in 97 on a Dutch label. In fact, I know that the Starry, Starry Night painting is at the Kruller Müller Museum, which is outside of Amsterdam.
Right.
In its natural placement. They do tour these paintings, but the Dutch people have been really good to me. I've spent a lot of time in Amsterdam, written a lot of songs in Amsterdam. It's one of my favorite cities, and I got to go there last summer with my partner, Jamie, and it was such a joy to be back. And the song captures that. Like, my favorite person, my favorite city, my favorite hotel. It's like, we're here. It's working. This is great. And it just is a unapologetically joyful song that it celebrates sort of getting out of the house, getting out of the country, getting back to what we do. It was that little window between Delta and Omicron, I think, when we thought the vaccines were a fix-all. We had that week there, and we started writing the song in the hotel room.
One of the other favorites on the album was "Truckers and Troubadours." I liked the title of it, but I liked the song. I just thought it was great.
Thank you.
Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wrote that on Zoom with a long haul truck driver. At the beginning of the pandemic, the only people on the roads were truckers. And we caught him in between a haul, we being myself and Darden Smith, the co-founder of Songwriting with Soldiers. And Paul is a friend, and Darden said, well, let's write a song with Long Haul Paul. I'm like, great. So we hopped on the Zoom and did a three-way write. And because Paul said, when I listen to you and Darden talk, it sounds like a bunch of truck drivers talking at a cafe. I'm like, troubadours and truckers have a lot in common. We're sort of similar personality types, malcontents. All we can think about is we want to get home, and when we get home, all we can think about is we want to get back on the road, and that's just how we do our life. And so we just started drawing the parallels in the verses around the life of a truck driver and a troubadour, and realize, gosh, we're kindred.
Yeah, well, I'm sure truckers have a lot of stories to tell as well, right?
They do.
They see a lot. They see a lot more than most people do.
They do. They meet people along the way. They do.
And they were our saviors during COVID.
They definitely kept things stocked. If without the truck drivers, and there were no rest stops for them, by the way. There were no restaurants for them. Everything was shut down, and so that's why Darden said, "Man, let's do this with Paul. Let's give something back to this guy. He's given us a lot, and that's such a good impulse." Yeah.
So you finished up the album with "Thank God for You," and why did you finish the album with that particular song? And tell me a little bit about it, because it seemed there was joy in it. There was also it seemed like it was almost about a particular person that meant something to you, but I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I think it's about it's a story song about finding love and the relief of finding love later in life and knowing that this isn't a given. And there's this just absolute gratitude that comes from finding your person in a miraculous way later in life, in all your broken glory and agedness, and having it be right. There's a magnificence to that is glorious. And the only thing I could think of is thank God for you, that this sense of acceptance of me, of who I am and all of my, imperfection, to say the least. I didn't find love young. It didn't work for me. I was just too much of a mess and a wreck. And in my defense, it wasn't all my fault. I had a pretty rough start, and I had a lot to work through. And I didn't understand that I really wasn't relationship material myself. And all of that information and all of that work culminated in preparing me for what was next. And, I guess the song is a celebration of having this connection to this person that I didn't know I would live long enough and get healthy enough to have. It is about Jamie, my partner, but it's also about doing the work and finding the person. It's about me, but it's also more than that. It's not everybody is able to do this when they're young because of trauma and addiction and hard stories. It's hard.
It's really hard to find the person that you love. My husband and I met each other when we were close to 40. And so we were late to that game as well. And I think there's a lot of self-doubt and wondering whether, is there something wrong with me? And maybe sometimes there is, and sometimes there isn't. But I think that we're all blessed if we can find that other person that really
Amen.
Loves us.
Yeah, amen. And so much of it has to do with timing, and so much of it has to do with just, I think, dumb luck. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm not one thinking of who thinks this is all destined. Like, no, I had to work real hard and change parts of myself that needed work, and still do in a lot of ways. But that didn't mean that I was gonna absolutely then find the person. Like, it kind of blessed luck.
Well, I'm so happy for you. It sounds like you're in an awesome place in your life with lots of good, great things going on personally and professionally. The new album is incredible, and I guess you're going to go out on tour soon, so everyone will get to see you soon.
We're hitting the road pretty hard with this one, yeah. I'll be out for quite a while. As many tour dates as they can get me, that's how many we're going to play. It'll be at least a solid year of running around, COVID willing.
Well, let us know if you're going to be in Memphis. We'd love
to have you
by the studio. So
I would like that. Thank you.
And Mary, have a great week. It's been a pleasure talking to you.
Appreciate talking to you. Thank you, Amy.
Thanks so much to Grammy-nominated and internationally adored singer-songwriter Mary Gaucher for stopping by to chat all about her latest record, the heartbreaking yet inspiring Dark Enough to See the Stars. Mary's visions of progress and the way she intuitively uses her voice in songwriting is truly admirable and worth learning more about. So we hope you enjoyed listening and that you'll do everything you can to support this courageous artist. From all of us at Diddy TV, thanks again for tuning in today, and we hope to see you again real soon, right here on Insights.